We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Insects posed a major threat to the economic aspirations of the Europeans who settled early America. Now, at first, this was a battle that was fought locally. People experimented, they found out what worked, and then they shared that information with their neighbors. In time, though, this is something that became a national effort as scientists became involved, and they worked to fight insects literally from coast to coast. These two approaches, they were very different, and they also had very different environmental impacts. This morning in this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with historian James McWilliams about his book, American Pests. The subtitle is The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times to DDT. It's a book that explores attitudes and techniques and indeed surveys this long battle against insects throughout American history. Our guest, James McWilliams, is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University San Marcos. He's also a recent fellow in the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University. He has contributed articles to a number of publications, including New York Times, the LA Times, Washington Post, and he is also the author of the book A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America. Professor McWilliams, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate it. Maybe it's a natural thing, as you did, as I said, write this book about eating and food. So maybe it's natural that you'd be interested in agriculture. And then, of course, for all farmers, all times, all places, insects are an issue.
Right.
Is there something, though, in particular that got you interested in looking at the history of the attempt to control insects?
Yeah, it was a kind of a convergence of factors. I mean, as you mentioned, I wrote this book on eating habits, and in doing the research for that book, you know, one thing that really impressed me in looking at a lot of the agricultural methods that farmers up and down the East Coast of the United States were practicing was, you know, how much attention they put into insect control. And on one hand, you think, oh, well, of course they did. It was a problem that was kind of hidden in plain sight. On the other hand, you know, historians have paid very, very little attention to the kinds of methods that these farmers were using to keep damaging insects out of their crops. You know, many of their crops were planted monoculturally, mm-hmm. So it was a constant battle. So, you know, that posed a question, and as any historian will tell you, that's the most important thing. I mean, you need a genuine question that you want to find an answer to, and so that was a spark. I mean, the other factor that I'll briefly mention is just kind of funny. I mean, at the time that I got interested in this question, my son was 2 years old, and, you know, two-year-old boys are just, and girls are fascinated with things that crawl, and he started to ask all these questions about these. I live in Texas, so they have all kinds of insects around us all the time, and he would ask questions, and I wouldn't know the answers, and then would start to research answers to questions about the bugs that he, insects that he was looking at, and you know, that got my interest going too. So I thought, I'll just try to combine these two trends and see what comes out of it. And, you know, once I dove in, it just proved to be fascinating, fascinating research.
So is that who Owen is?
Yes.
Is that your son? Okay.
Right.
I see the book's dedicated to him.
Indeed.
Well,
deservedly.
the point, I guess, we can talk a little bit more about it, and I think this is, you've just touched on it, but it's really important, is that in early America, the economy was based on cash crops, and we had entire, as you note in the book, we had entire regions whose economies were based around maybe just one or two crops.
Right.
And so that means if you've got an insect problem, you've got a big problem.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the ironies, is that the early American farmers, you know, of European descent who came to the colonies really were under the burden of producing a cash crop very quickly. And so in the southern regions, you had rice. As you moved up the coast, you had tobacco. And then as you moved into the mid-Atlantic region, you had wheat, and much less so in New England, but you had corn. I wouldn't call it necessarily a monocultural crop, but it approached it. And it's a sort of basic botanical principle that if you, in a sense, replace the biodiversity of a region with one or two crops, it can become a kind of massive smorgasbord for the insect world. And insects can very rapidly adjust to the presence of this single crop and effectively destroy it. So while as a researcher, I was in this position of in many ways feeling empathy and in many cases frustration and sadness for the farmers that I was studying, as well as admiration for their ability to fight back against these insects. But on the other hand, as I argue and point out in the book, I also have to place the blame on them for making these agricultural choices, which they were increasingly well aware of.
Yeah. Well, in addition to doing this thing that we've talked about, that is monocropping or planting maybe one or two things and planting a lot of it, something else that they did on the East Coast that made things worse, that was really dramatic and widespread deforestation. They cut down a lot of trees. They saw the trees as an important resource and one that they felt foolish not to exploit, and they did.
It's an interesting trees are an interesting kind of starting point to look at the relationships between the Europeans and the land and also the Europeans and the Native Americans. And, you know, one of the things that Europeans simply could not understand about the Native Americans that they encountered on the East Coast was why they were not harvesting this precious natural resource. And, of course, there were timber shortages all over Europe at the time, and England was getting most of its timber from Scandinavia in the 17th century. So for the Europeans to come over and encounter these large pine and hardwood forests was a gold mine in a sense, and they harvested it quite rapidly to the point where, you know, after 100 years, entire regions had been deforested. And Native Americans, of course, were not engaged in these international commodity markets, and therefore, used. Of course, they certainly used the timber resources, but had a much smaller footprint on the environment as a result. So that you have this rapid and comparatively massive deforestation, which also, in a sense, kind of creates an ecosystem that is also prone to and vulnerable to insect attacks. I mean, there's a whole field of disturbance ecology that looks at what happens when you rapidly alter a landscape, and the entomological response to that can, in many cases, be dramatic. Now, I didn't have the records at the time aren't nearly precise enough for me to make those kind of connections, but I felt fairly safe in theorizing in the book that the deforestation that accompanied a lot of the monocropping and cattle ranching was very much linked to intensified levels of insect attacks.
Well, did this have something to do with changing the conditions, changing because you took the trees away, or was it also what they put in place of the trees?
It was both. I mean, just taking the trees away, if you want to just take it down to an ecological perspective, if you go ahead and remove the trees, well, the snow that falls in the winter is going to melt earlier because the sun is going to hit it, and larvae that might not make it through the spring and because of late frosts end up do making it, and of course they're going to look for the nearest food source, which in many cases might be the newly planted monocrops. And so again, one of the frustrating parts of doing research in the 17th and 18th century is we don't necessarily have precision of record keeping that you would have in the 19th or 20th century. But, again, I felt fairly comfortable in arguing that, drawing on kind of contemporary studies of ecological relationships between plants and insects, and hypothesizing that this indeed was going on quite regularly in early America. And again, reiterating what I think is an important point, that colonists were in many ways the victims of their own behavior. And it didn't take them long to realize. I mean, they were so perceptive of environmental connections. And this is kind of a whole other issue. We tend to think of early Americans as being unaware of ecology or unaware of environmental aspects of their lives. But in fact, they knew how the environment worked inside and out because they were out there every day observing ecological relationships. So it didn't take them long to realize that, you know, planting monoculturally or rapidly deforesting a landscape could have negative consequences in terms of insect outbreaks. But the motivation for them to reform their agricultural habits wasn't there because there was so much land. And so whenever they would encounter these massive outbreaks, and as they became aware of the connection, it just was cheaper, easier, faster, and more short-term profitable for them to simply clear more landscape, plant more crops.
Are there reliable figures on numbers, that is, as a result of the kind of things that we're talking about, how much the sheer numbers of insects increased?
By the 19th century, with the establishment of the Division of Entomology within the USDA, so we're talking about 1860s, you do start to get semi-annual government reports indicating X number of acres of wheat were damaged and the cost was X number of millions of dollars. And this quantification was really important. I don't dwell on it too much in my book, but I think somewhere in there I do mention that when farmers started to actually see, and farmers and scientists and entomologists started to actually see numerically the damage that was being done by insect outbreaks, the imperative to come up with a solution that was more potent, more universal, more universally applicable, and of course more chemically based became that much more urgent. So, you know, in a lot of ways, our 18th century farmers, everyone knew that insects were a problem, and everyone knew every year their crops had a certain percentage of their crops or a certain, you know, acreage of their crops were damaged by insects, but nobody really had a quantifiable sense of how bad the problem was. And then the Division of Entomology comes along in the 1860s and starts to quantify that, and then suddenly you have a quote-unquote national crisis. And I think that definition, you know, a national crisis, then changes the nature of how farmers, scientists, government officials should approach the problem.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is James McWilliams. He is Associate Professor of History at Texas State University, San Marcos, and he is the author of the book American Pests, The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times to DDT. If you're interested, you could seek it out. Questions here on the program are certainly welcome. The number is 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have toll-free lines. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Columbia University Press, the publisher on the book. Something that I think is really interesting and something that I think is very telling the way that it changes over time is the attitudes people had toward insects.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that early on in the early period that we're talking about, the attitude that farmers had was that insects were very powerful creatures. They were really beyond any ability of human beings to control them. And it seems that in a sense they had a certain respect for them.
Yeah.
And they're as a force of nature.
Yeah. Let me start by giving a little bit of context to this because I think it's pretty interesting. Indeed, you're right. There was this grudging respect that farmers had for insects, mainly because at the time, Europeans really defined their ability as farmers. They defined their independence, and they defined their status as farmers, largely through their ability to domesticate animals. So your ability to control your pigs and to control your cows and your chickens and your sheep and whatever livestock you were keeping, careful domestication and confident domestication reflected very well on a farmer. And you know, it's worth noting that this also played into a lot of the negative perceptions that developed about Native Americans. Now, of course, Europeans hunted, but Europeans hunted largely as a leisure activity. And so when when they arrived in the New World and quickly observed that most Native Americans, or all the Native Americans that they encountered, were hunting for primary sustenance rather than domesticating animals, they interpreted this as a mark of savagery. And so it's important to understand that point, to understand their attitudes towards insects, because they encountered this world and they quickly domesticated the animals that they were capable of domesticating, and in some cases even took some animals that were wild and domesticated them, for example, with the turkey. And insects, of course, they resisted this and this domestication. And the response on the part of the colonists was, of course, frustration, but also, a little bit to my shock, I was finding passage after passage of people writing about insects with a certain amount of admiration. And bees and ants in particular elicited tremendous amounts of glowing reports from colonists. And the Puritans in New England actually would write sermons about the beehive or the ant colony, because you have this model society of, you know, individual units working together to create a whole, which was very much along the lines of the societies that the Puritans were interested in establishing. So you can go to the sermons of Cotton Mather, and he has long pieces on the model societies that that bees were creating, and that how humans should follow that. But, you know, there was never this sense that we understand this animal, we can control this animal, we can feed it, we can be in charge of its reproduction schedule. And as a result, that created a certain amount of awe, a certain amount of respect. And one thing that really impressed me, I read everything I could on the matter, nobody ever used the word exterminate. Nobody ever said we need to exterminate these insects, we need to get rid of them. That just never crossed anyone's mind at the time. Instead, it was control, manage, do the best we can under the circumstances. Now, of course, that would change late in the 19th century, but prior to the advent of chemicals, the goal was always control, management, minimization.
Well, what in this period here, again, when we get to, when we're still in the period before the rise of the professional entomologist, sure. Mm-hmm. And before we get on to the point where there were more and more chemical controls widely available, if you look at this earlier time, what sorts of things did farmers do?
Well, they had a wide variety of practices, and this was, in many ways, as I kind of indicated earlier, it was very exciting to me to see the innovations that they undertook. They did use natural chemicals, two natural chemicals that worked very well for them was pyrethrum, ground up from the chrysanthemum plant and mixed, I think, with some kind of soda. And nicotine powder worked very well to control insects in certain circumstances as well. So those are sort of two examples of some natural chemical solutions that they would employ. But they also, again, relied heavily on this habit of ecological observation. So they might note that when a certain kind of weed, say some kind of vetch, was growing nearby the vegetable garden, that a particular kind of insect might migrate towards the vetch rather than the vegetables. And then they would cultivate these weeds around the vegetables to lure insects away from them. Landon Carter, who was a very well-known and prominent tobacco farmer in 18th century Virginia, did this religiously. He was constantly cultivating weeds around his tobacco crops to draw out the hornworm, and then the tobacco fly. And he wrote at great length about how this worked and became very frustrated when his fellow tobacco farmers wouldn't take his advice, because the idea of cultivating weeds, why would anybody do that? But, you know, he saw that connection and wrote about it. I found examples of farmers cultivating mustard seed around corn crops because it would lure out particular beetles that were attacking the corn. So lots of lure crops. And again, what's important to note here is none of these techniques became standardized. They were really used in a particular time and place. Farmers would write about it in the local newspaper Others would try it. If it worked, great. If it didn't, they would try something else. So you had to have this habit of flexibility, this willingness to undertake trial and error. Another solution was to, you know, come up with some kind of trap. And one of the most innovative traps that I found was it was in New England near the coast, and they were taking lobster claws and taking these hollowed out lobster claws and lining them with some kind of sweetener, maybe some molasses or honey, and setting those up around a crop and, you know, luring out ants or luring out beetles or flies that were attacking the particular cash crop in question. Mm. So that should give you some taste of what we're talking about here. I mean, what it all boils down to is a tremendous amount of trial and error, and ultimately what I think is a really impressive level of innovation based on deep ecological knowledge.
Once we get into the, say, early 1800s, you start to see the rise of professional entomologists whose specialty was dealing with insects that attack cultivated crops.
Right.
And there are a number of them. The first that you write about was a man named Thaddeus Harris. And then there were others like Asa Finch, who was the first ever state entomologist that was in the state of New York. So there were a number of these men who were scientists who were trying to apply science to the problem and who were very concerned with trying to do something that would help farmers, because clearly farmers needed the help.
Yeah, this is an interesting group of men. There weren't many of them, but starting in about 1840, you started to see the rise of these. 40 years earlier, 30 years earlier, you would have called them naturalists, people who went out into the field and collected specimens and preserved them and cataloged them and wrote to each other about what they had found. But what made these guys different, people like Harris and Asa Fitch and Townend Glover, was the fact that they really had one eye on the farmer. And so most of these guys came from humble backgrounds. They weren't like previous naturalists from elite backgrounds that generally allowed them to have the leisure time to collect insects. They really came from, more working-class, working-based backgrounds. And so they had some sympathy for agricultural troubles, and all of them in one way or another had been involved in farming. So they started to really look and try to create some sort of systematic information about what insects attacked what crops at what time of the year. And then what really was important was they started to both study and then publish in the popular press information on insect life cycles, because a major problem with some of the early techniques that we were talking about earlier was there was no sense of when to apply these methods during an insect life cycle. It was just done when you saw the bugs on your crops. And of course, what these entomologists were able to do was to say, look, if you attack these insects before they hatch, when they're in their larval phase, if you use your pyrethrum dust or your nicotine dust now, instead of, if you use it in February instead of in March, it's going to make a world of difference. And in many cases, it did. So the blending of the on-the-ground innovations pioneered by the farmers with the study of life cycles and the publication of life cycle information by these entomologists led to dramatic gains in insect control. The other thing that I would really point out here is that, and again, it's one of those things I wish I had maybe developed a little more in my book, but I do mention it, is a lot of these early entomologists had to be excellent draftsmen. They had to draw very well with a tremendous amount of detail. And one of the quieter pleasures of my research was just admiring the artistic talent of these early entomologists. So they were really multi-talented scientists with interest in both, quote-unquote pure science, but also applied science as well. And I write about them quite favorably in the book, because I think that they accomplished the remarkable task of making dramatic improvements in insect control without resorting to the one-size-fits-all solution.
Mm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, James McWilliams. He's Associate Professor of History at Texas State University San Marcos, recent fellow in the Agrarian Studies Program at Yale University, author of the book A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America, and the book that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled American Pests, The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times to DDT. It's published by Columbia University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe it was about this time, or maybe a little bit later in the 1800s, there is an important change in thinking, I think, and in attitudes. And you talked a little bit earlier about how in early America, earlier on, people had a kind of grudging respect for the insect. At least they recognized that there was only so much that they could do, that they would do what they could, and then they'd say, well, insects are very powerful, and there are an awful lot of them. Then we come to a point where things start to change. And you talked about how earlier on, if you read what people write about insects and dealing with insects, that nobody used the word extermination. Well, we get to a point here, though, where people start to perhaps more and more talk about insect as the enemy, particularly in the home, and that it was something that could and must be controlled. And it seems that that's an important change.
Yeah, I mean, I think the change. I would identify this change around the late 19th, early 20th century. And there's a number of contributing factors, and I'll just kind of go over them briefly. But yes, you do start to see scientists and farmers talk quite explicitly and confidently about exterminating insects. And you know, to me, that was a really interesting rhetorical change. I mean, over a 50-year period, you see this discussion of insects being something that, you know, you do your best to control, to being something that you do everything you can to wipe off the face of the earth. So, you know, I really became interested in answering that question. How do people start to think that way? Well, one factor is, you know, the advent of some early chemicals. Arsenic-based insecticides, Paris Green, London Purple, were the two most popular manufactured insecticides that farmers started to use really in about the 1870s and 80s, but by the 1890s and early 20th century, they were used quite regularly. And the way these chemicals worked is the first time you used them, they would be incredibly powerful. And, you know, it was very difficult for me to find farmers actually describing what they felt when they applied this new chemical and all of their potato beetles fell off of their crops and died right in front of them. But I imagine it must have been a tremendously empowering experience for these farmers to try this new product, watch it literally work before their eyes, and have one, two, maybe three seasons of great abundance as a result of this chemical. Now, of course, what we know now is that, and really what they knew by 1910, was that these insects were quickly evolving the ability to get around these chemical insecticides, to adjust to them, and to become immune to their initial poisonous. They became resistant. So I think, though, that sort of early experience that many farmers had the first time they used chemicals gave them such an empowering feeling that, sure, why not entertain the idea of extermination? And this was only perpetuated throughout the early 20th century. So when a particular insecticide became ineffective as a result of insect resistance, farmers simply went on the lookout for something different, something more powerful, and the same cycle would be repeated. So I think there's a kind of psychological element there. But there's something else, too, and that is that in 1899, it became clear to the world that malaria was spread by insects, mosquitoes, the Anopheles mosquitoes to be precise. And that lent an urgency to insect control, that kind of annual and gradual insect attacks on crops didn't. I think when it became clear that mosquitoes can kill people, there was an expectation by the general public that these this is a public health threat. This isn't an agricultural threat. This is a public health threat, and the strongest guns need to be drawn as a result. A final point here would be actually World War One. World War One led to the production of so many chemicals to protect soldiers from insects, lice and fleas and ticks, and they worked very well. And after the war, there was this sense that, you know, chemicals are really a viable solution to the insect problem, not just in terms of public health, not just in terms of our military effectiveness, but also in terms of our crop production. And so, you know, in the 1920s, it's no surprise that you start to see an explosion after World War One, an explosion of chemical insecticides, and they're applied more or less without any sort of restraint, dropped from, you know, airplanes and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's a complex transition, but, you know, there's a number of factors involved.
All right, let's talk with somebody here. I want to join in the conversation. Someone on a cell phone on our line four. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm in my late 60s, and I noticed that there has been a significant reduction in the fields around where I live of small animals, pheasants, rabbits, quail, birds, different species of birds, since the farming has been more of a monocultural experience rather than a wide-based food sources. Is there, and obviously they use a lot of chemicals to kill all the bugs, and is there a relationship between killing all the bugs and killing all the small animals?
Well, Rachel Carson would have certainly thought so. I mean, this is Rachel Carson.
I may have read her book, too.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, she's the one who started to really make this connection between, primarily the birds. I mean, the first, let me just sort of back up a little bit. I mean, it's a great question, no easy answer to it. But the first public sense that there might be a problem with spraying chemicals in terms of wildlife biodiversity actually wasn't in an agricultural context, but it was in an urban context. And when trees started, you know, city trees started to die of certain insect infestations or fungal diseases, of course, cities would spray. And, of course, a lot of people started to notice that the bird populations were declining as a result. And that 1940s, 1950s is really when the general public started to make that connection. And, of course, Rachel Carson took it to an entirely new level by showing how DDT bioaccumulated and moved up the food chain and, of course, had a hazardous effect on not only insects but anything that ate insects as well. And so, yes, I mean, I think on the one hand, you could certainly theorize that what you've observed is a decline in biodiversity with fewer small mammals or perhaps a change in the bird population. I'm sure it could be linked to the insecticides and pesticides that are commonly used to grow corn monoculturally. But I think, you know, an ecologist would complicate it a little more and just simply say, look, I mean, when you take a region that once had, some of the best soil in the world because it had natural grass growing on it, and, over several generations, remove those natural grasses, you know, you break the plains and you plant these corn crops, I mean, you're going to see a decline in biodiversity just by due to the fact that you've limited the food supply and limited the biodiversity so dramatically. So I don't know that you would actually see that happen in the course of your own life, but I think it's quite possible. Another factor that I think would play into this that might contribute to your observation or might help explain your observation is the fact that, you know, growing corn requires so much nitrogen-based fertilizer, and this runs off into the local aquatic ecosystem, and of course, when there's algae blooms, that is going to take oxygen out of the water, and that will reverberate up the food chain as well and have, you know, a kind of ripple effect beyond just algae growing in the water.
Well, since we've just, you know, kind of begun this monocultural growing of food sources, is there any chance that we will damage the ecosystem to the extent that will no longer be viable? I mean, is it not in one lifetime, not in two lifetimes, but in centuries?
I mean, frankly, I think it has been ruined. I mean, I think if you look at what...
It's already been ruined.
The Midwest, if you look at what the Midwest looked like in the 19th century, you know, prior to Western exploration, and look at it now, I mean, you've seen the transformation from, well, like I said earlier, the richest...
Right.
You know, some of the richest soil in the world to some of the most dried out soil in the world. Now, fortunately, landscapes can be recovered, and one of the more frustrating aspects of my research was, you know, there was always, I mean, going back to the 18th century, there were always groups of agricultural reformers saying, look, this is what we need to do. We need to diversify. We need to have crop rotations. We need to let fields sit fallow for a while. We need to carefully integrate livestock into these agricultural systems.
Is that not what they do in Australia in terms of the rotating off of cattle and food source and grain sources? Rotate those around so that
Yeah, they call it nutrient balancing, and quite honestly, I think I can't speak to how extensively they do it, but some of the most I know somebody's doing it there because some of the most authoritative writing on nutrient balance, where you do balance crop production with livestock, is happening in Australia and does come out of Australia. It's a very difficult balance to strike, obviously, but it's promoted as an antidote to overgrazing and monocultural production. Bring these two systems together in a way that they enhance each other rather than pound the soil and dry out the soil.
Yeah.
I think we're living in an age right now where discussions about sustainable agriculture have, you know, it's quite intense. Maybe the most intense it's been in 100 years, 150 years. So, I mean, there is hope. And, you know, I think fortunately a landscape that's been leached of its nutrients can also be reclaimed. And big problem, of course, is there has to be some kind of incentive for that to happen. And the way subsidies are structured right now, there's very little incentives for farmers to practice restorative agricultural practices.
Well, I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left, and I have another caller I want to get in and also introduce once again the guest, James McWilliams. He's an historian at Texas State University, San Marcos. He's author of the book American Pests, which takes a look at the history of the war on insects from colonial times to DDT. It's published by Columbia University Press. We have another caller. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Up next, someone in Batavia, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. A great topic, actually. I've been trying to eradicate pests on my lawns and in my trees and just basically all my shrubs the natural way, instead of using chemicals. And, you know, I laugh because, you know, we forget when we built all these houses around here in these subdivisions, all this water runoff and places that used to not have water runoff now is going everywhere where it's not supposed to be. We're supposed to be keeping the environment clean, and now everybody's worried about greenhouse gases. But I think we pollute more with all the chemicals that we put down on our lawns every day. Having grown up in the Southwest, I could tell you that most of my yard was dirt. with Joshua trees on it.
There's a big movement right now in Central Texas to, you know, xeriscape your lawn, to just, you know, plant... remove any kind of grass that's not native, and to plant native plants. And for some reason that I can't quite put my finger on. There's actually a great book about it called The Crabgrass Frontier. But, you know, Americans love their lush green lawns, And
well, they're going to pay for it now, especially in Phoenix and California and Nevada. They're right. So, you know, we're all worried about gas, but, you know, they're fighting a border war now with water, and I'm just, it's going to be double the price of gas.
Yeah, I mean, we have water. We have very serious water restrictions here in Texas right now. I know California does as well. But I think you raise a very interesting point, which is, you know, we're talking about pesticides and insecticides, but all of these issues are related, and water is becoming an increasingly urgent matter when we think about agriculture. And you know, on a personal level, I the idea of having a big lawn and watering it. It's something I would never do. I think it's incredibly wasteful. You know, on the other hand, I'm aware that this is a longstanding sort of cultural habit. There's an aesthetic element to this. People love their large green lawns. And, you know, I think you just have to begin by making people aware of how wasteful they are. And so, you know, this can be done on a municipal level. I know in the city I live, like I said, there are, you know, very strict regulations on what you can do in terms of watering. And every day the newspaper's writing something about it, and there fortunately is a growing and I think important movement towards planting native drought-resistant plants in your yard.
Yeah. Again, I want to thank the caller and invite some others, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Something else I'd like to have you talk a little bit about, you talked earlier about how, let's say, early on when people started to use chemical controls, some of the things they used, for example, were arsenic compounds, mm-hmm. which would not only have been hazardous to the insects, they would have been hazardous. They're going to be just as poisonous to people as to bugs, and certainly there are using chemical pesticides have risks. What sort of health risks were there, particularly early on, and was this something that government was concerned about?
Yeah, there was a big scare in 1925, and the United States was growing apples, drying them out, and sending them to Europe. And in 1925, a number of citizens in the UK became sick due to arsenic, high arsenic levels or arsenic dust residue on these dried apples, and it became the poison apple scare. And this was a bit of a flashpoint for public concern about arsenic residue levels on left on fruit that people were consuming. What's kind of interesting to me is how the government, of course, took it very seriously because this was a trade matter, you know, and they wanted to alleviate foreign concerns about the quality of U.S. produce, and so they quickly stepped in and started to establish limitations on how much residue could be left on crops, and so USDA officials started to test exports initially for residue of arsenic dust. And if you were over the limit, you couldn't, you know, you lost your crop. And so there was some incentive for farmers in the late 1920s to start scaling back. Now, it's important to point out here that, you know, I feel like once a Rubicon is crossed, I mean, once you start using these chemicals, I'm hard-pressed to find a historical precedent of going back. And so I think there was this widespread recognition that, okay, the goal now isn't to stop using chemicals and figure out another way to solve the problem. The goal now is how to use these in a safe and reasonable way. And I think that's an important question, and I think it's an important question today. I mean, at one point in my book do I advocate eliminating pesticides or insecticides. I think that would ultimately be dangerous to the food supply. What really matters is how the chemicals are applied and what kind of regulations and what kind of limits are placed upon them. And this is where I think a major failure occurred, because what many chemical corporations were able to do was to say, look, we agree with these laws. We want laws. We want a safe food supply. So we're going to help support this legislation. Of course, then what their lobbyists would do is write this kind of watered-down legislation. So what they were able to do was, on the one hand, say, we support this legislation because we want the government to protect you, and we want to help the government do that so our products don't hurt you. And they could sort of take the public relations high ground on that point. Meanwhile, what they were doing under the scenes is establishing this precedent where if anybody complained or anybody said, look, this arsenic residue made me sick, they would need a smoking gun. If somebody said, I got cancer as a result of arsenic, they'd say, where's the smoking gun? Can you prove it? And so what they did was they established this burden of proof that was impossible to achieve. So many public interest groups were saying, hey, we found these links. We think there are these links between chronic arsenic accumulation and cancer. And, of course, these companies would say, well, show us that smoking gun. And, of course, the scientists couldn't. And, therefore, the rubber really never hit the road in terms of real stringent regulations. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, that's why DDT entered, you know, in the 1940s and 1950s, entered the agricultural system with such ease and such force was corporations had done a very good job of creating these large loopholes for these new chemicals to enter the market. And again, they could just say, look, nobody has proven that chronic accumulation causes any problems. Acute, there may be acute poisoning, yeah, we'll acknowledge that, but a chronic poisoning, nobody's ever shown us that.
We have about 3-4 minutes left. I want to sort of come around again to talk a little bit more about where we've been and where we are. And earlier we talked about how in early America that farmers particularly had this kind of grudging respect for insects. At least they regarded them as a force of nature and that there was only so much they could do. Mm. They did that, and they tried to use biological controls where they found that they worked, and they did things that I think now we would call integrated pest management. Mm-hmm. But then when we get into, say, the early 19th and maybe the 20th centuries, we see more and more chemical controls, things that are very effective, but also things that have environmental downsides. And then we come to Rachel Carson and Silent Spring and the beginnings of the modern environmental movement. And now it seems at least we have growing numbers of people who are concerned, concerned about the environment, concerned about the impact of things like agriculture and also what they do in their own yards. And we, I think, start to see that we're at least a little bit coming back to some of the same attitudes maybe that people in early America had.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very much an alternative movement, this kind of movement towards you know, organic farming or using more natural methods of control. However, while it's an alternative movement that the vast majority of farmers don't use, it does seem to be getting more attention than it has ever gotten before, which is a good thing. I think it's increasingly important to be aware that there is such a thing as integrated pest management and that it can lead to significant reductions in pesticide application. So, you know, I do see that the rhetoric is at least out there. But, you know, in terms of the application of conventional pesticides, it's only increasing every year. And, you know, I don't foresee any kind of movement back towards, at least on a mass level, movement back towards any kind of 18th century techniques or practices. You know, and it's probably a good thing. I always sort of look at other methods of pest control and innovations with great interest, such as sterilization techniques and in some cases genetically modified crops as well. I mean, I sort of am willing to entertain anything that will allow us to spray fewer harmful chemicals on crops. But, you know, I think another thing to keep in mind is that I think it's safe to say that the chemicals that we are spraying today, while by no means universally safe, at least in this country, are much safer than they were in the 1950s and 1960s. And, you know, I think Silent Spring and the environmental legislation that came out of the Nixon administration did have a positive impact, at least on the toxicity of the chemicals that we're spraying today. And there are some scientists who assure us that, you know, the fruit that we eat, what we're getting out of that fruit is just infinitely better than, you know, it's the vitamins that we're getting out of it far counteract any dangers that the residue pesticides might cause. I'm not sure I fully agree with that, but nevertheless, there are highly qualified people out there making that argument.
And you, just real quick, what the potential is, do you think, for consumer-driven demand to change the system that we have? Or is it just that it's so big and the amounts of food it has to produce are so big that there's only so much that we can do?
Well, yeah, I think there is only so much we can do as individual consumers. I mean, there are a number of alternatives out there for I think, that are available to a lot of people. You know, we're trying to buy local. We're trying to buy from farmers who we can say, hey, what kind of chemicals do you use? I think we're trying, in many cases, to grow some of our own food. I mean, all of these are trends. Again, they're very small. However, I think they're important. And, you know, another thing that I think is critical that we do is just simply be aware that when we eat food that's, you know, grown on the other side of the world, we don't know. We don't know what we're getting. And I think one thing I would like to see is much more transparency on the part of the producers of our food, no matter where they are. So if you're buying peppers from Holland, I don't think there's any reason why there can't be a barcode that you can scan. You know, again, I'm thinking pie in the sky here, but a barcode that you can scan and every chemical that was used to grow that product comes up. There's no reason why we can't have access to that kind of information. It's done nutritionally. Everything, you know, all the nutritional information is placed on a can of soup. There's no reason why it can't be done in terms of the chemicals used. So a certain amount of activism is required for that.
There, we'll have to leave it. Our guest, James McWilliams, Associate Professor of History at Texas State University, San Marcos. His book, American Pests, The Losing War on Insects, From Colonial Times to DDT. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.